Hi everyone, I'm Elizabeth Stein, founder and CEO of Purely Elizabeth, and this is Live Purely with Elizabeth, featuring candid conversations about how to thrive on your wellness journey. This week's guest is Robbie Sansom, co-founder and CEO at Force of Nature, a regeneratively sourced meat company based in Austin. Previously CFO, COO at Epic Foods, Robbie spent much of the last decade studying regenerative agriculture at ranches all over the world. Through this education, Force of Nature was co-founded with the intention to accelerate the creation of a global regenerative supply network. Force of Nature works in partnership with land stewards, ranchers, and farmers committed to creating a positive return on the planet. In this episode, we talk about Robbie's journey building Epic and selling to General Mills, which set the stage for Force of Nature, committing to human health, sustainability, and animal welfare. We talk about the why we need a shift towards regenerative agriculture, the issues with our current food system, including the impact of the Farm Bill. Robbie shares about the relationship between animals and the land, addressing the misconceptions about the impact of meat on the environment, and emphasizing the importance of diversity and ecosystems. I'm such a huge fan of everything that Robbie and the team are doing at Force of Nature. To try out and support a better food system, use code LIVEPURELY at forceofnature.com. Enjoy the episode. Robbie, welcome to the podcast. It's an absolute pleasure. I'm so excited to really meet you and just so admire everything that you guys are doing.
Well, I'm excited to be here. As we were saying a little beforehand, fan of yours as well, and all the things that you've done and been a part of. So grateful for this opportunity and for what you've done. Fan of that as well.
Awesome. Well, you know, really wanting to use this time today to talk about your story, what you guys are doing, and I think really help educate our community. We're on a regen journey ourselves and really look up to you guys for what you're doing, the transformations you're making. And I think really being able to take away the impact and kind of some misconceptions that people might be having on meat and plant-based and all of those good things. So before we dive into all those issues, let's start with a little bit of your background prior to Force of Nature and how you first got involved with Epic. I think I've heard that you were childhood friends with Katie and Taylor, but let's hear that story.
Yeah, I knew Katie and Taylor before they knew each other, each individually. So Katie and I grew up in the same neighborhood together. She was a little bit younger, but was really good friends with our next door neighbor. So she was kind of, in some senses, the girl next door. I was in charge of all the lifeguards in our neighborhood and the pool. And so, you know, again, we just grew up together in the same neighborhood. And Taylor and I are the same age. So, you know, we were seniors when Katie was a freshman, but we all went to Austin High School. Taylor and I went to middle school together. So we knew each other for a long time. And, you know, their story, if you ever hear them tell it, you know, they crossed paths in high school, but their relationship really blossomed in college. And so, you know, we all grew up strangely. We're some of the few born and raised Austinites. And, you know, I kind of took this really formal path, go to university, get a master's degree, go to work for one of the big firms that everybody competes for the jobs, you know, get herded down the path that is supposed to be the path to success, however that, you know, might be defined in that by academia. And, you know, they went and pretty quickly hit the eject button on, you know, the rat race and just started being entrepreneurs. I was a little later to the game, but decided that I needed to tap out of the, you know, the race myself and went on, you know, about a 6-month sabbatical just to figure out like, let me just talk and listen and learn from anybody and everybody that'll sit with me and find a path that inspires me. Because, you know, if the pursuit of money is the objective, you lost me. You know, like, there has to be something fulfilling and rewarding and bigger than that in life, surely, right? And I went into the startup world, and the first company I went to work for, within my first year, we were number 21 on the Inc. 500. I was an executive at 25, had 100 people rolling up to me.
Wow.
it was wild. You know, it was just a crash course, and I made a ton of mistakes, got a ton of things right, learned a lot. You know, meanwhile, they're just doing business. And so we ended up crossing paths. They were into endurance sports, doing triathlon. So was I. So we would ride, we would catch up, we would stay friendly and connected. And, you know, they hit a point where, and this kind of answers a little bit of like your lead in with some of the polarization of meat versus not, but you know, the roots of Epic are a vegan energy bar company.
I remember Thunderbird well.
Exactly. And that was the name of the company. I mean, it was Thunderbird LLC that they started. And so that became Epic once they realized that they were experiencing health challenges, contrary to the dogma that they were fed and the promises that they were, that led them down that path. You know, they had health challenges, but their value set didn't change. You know, they still cared about human health. They still cared about the health of lands and, you know, the sustainability of our wild places. They still cared about ethics and welfare of animals and people and food producing communities and the welfare of consumers, honestly, who are kind of victims and the failures of our food system. And so some of those vegan ideals perpetuated from that initial brand into Epic, you know, and that was where the pursuit of healthy protein, or as we said at the time, protein as nature intended, in a space, you know, snacking performance that was overwhelmed with sugar, grain-based options, things like that. I mean, stuff where there's a time and place for, but you know, there's alternatives, those alternatives weren't represented. And so we, you know, kind of brought that meat opportunity forward, but we didn't want to lose those ideals. And so, you know, that's where we went down the rabbit hole of like, where the heck does healthy meat come from? How do you honor animal welfare? How do you honor, you know, making a positive impact on land and people, and do it by supporting meat? Because we were told back at this time that those things were mutually exclusive. And that, of course, turned out not to be the case. And we've gone, you know, spent the last decade forging some of that path and being the benefactors of many other, you know, giants whose shoulders we stand on, but learning a lot about the myths and truths behind the animal agriculture industry. We were fortunate to do Epic at the right time and find that path that those things could be done, and that resonated with other people and consumers. And, you know, we sold Epic to General Mills, had a profoundly positive impact. I think some at the time viewed that as selling out. We viewed that as big plus bad is really fucking bad, but big plus good is really fucking good. Sorry for the language, but you know, if we want to see change, it doesn't come with, you know, having small brands that only we get to have exclusively. You know, like, you need to drive change at scale, and these large organizations have that capacity and potential. And General Mills is the first company to make a regenerative commitment, first Fortune 500 company. And many other large companies have followed. So, you know, we funded a massive life cycle assessment, you know, that proved empirically that regenerative practices and with rumen and animal proteins like beef, you could have a positive impact on carbon issues. Even some of the leading alternatives like Beyond or Impossible can't make that claim. They still produce more carbon than they can sequester. And so tons of stuff that we're proud of there. And then that leads to Force of Nature, right? The evolution of that same mission, that we can improve our agriculture system. And in this case, not just animal agriculture, but plant agriculture, right? Nobody deserves a free pass. Our system is broken. It takes both plants and animals functioning in harmony and thriving ecosystems to produce a food system that drives solutions. And that's the message that we want to get out. And, you know, we've shifted our focus from ounces of snacks to pounds of primary meals. And yeah, we're excited to be here. It's been a pretty wild ride, but we're encouraged.
Well, it's incredible what you guys are doing, and the scale at which, as you said, taking Epic to selling to General Mills, which total agreement was really the best thing for the mission, to be able to reach that many more people and have that much more impact on the land. And now what you're doing at Force of Nature is just, not to use the word, but is epic. So
I feel like I want to use the word epic, and there was a long period of my life where I couldn't, because it was, you know, just too ironic. So
yeah,
I feel like I'm,
are you back to using it again?
I'm finally at a place where if I use it, people don't, you know, nudge me like, funny pun, and, you know, haha. So right. it's a little freeing.
So when you first started with Epic, obviously the land and animals were at the forefront of the mission. Was regen part of the conversation at that time? Were you guys so ahead of your time talking about that? I can't remember.
No, it wasn't. Gluten-free, yeah. Paleo, low glycemic, you know, those were pretty trendy. Meat was under attack, not as amplified as it's been these last couple of years. But regenerative agriculture wasn't even a whisper. It was way underground. And, you know, it was only in that journey that I led into a second ago of us searching for a path to animal products that we could be proud of, that we found that rabbit hole that we've since dove into. And, you know, regenerative has emerged in the decades since. It's still, you know, not reaching mainstream, but it's in the public discourse.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily entirely unheard of. It's more than a whisper now. There's a groundswell clearly forming and being called out as a trend. And it's at that stage now where it's at risk of being greenwashed. But yeah, we partnered with Savory Institute very early on, and they're a global organization that creates a hub and spoke network. So they have representation on all the continents where there's agriculture or animal agriculture, and they have essentially peers in a community that are practicing this way of producing food that folks can turn to for support, advocacy, community, education, training, and it be contextual, at least from a geographic perspective, right? You can't expect somebody in the Northwest to use the same strategy as somebody in the arid South. You know, there's just different opportunities and risks and challenges. And so Savory has been working on this for decades, and we partnered with them early on as we learned about regenerative and about this opportunity and how do we create scale, you know, and how do we convince people that this is worth pursuing so that we could generate supply that we were proud to put into our products. Because, you know, our first core value at Epic was what we called the golden rule of food: feed others as you wish to be fed. And so that was how we stumbled into it, but then joined forces with it. You know, there's so many good people all over the planet, not just in the States. You know, in fact, it's probably more advanced and more supported in other countries and continents. And it's been around for a long time. And we came in rather late. You know, it's just earlier than most here domestically.
Absolutely. So let's get into some of those big benefits. You touched on the research that you did with General Mills at the time on the impact of the life assessment climate impact, and certainly versus a Beyond Burger or the likes of that. But let's start to dive into, maybe take a step back and say, you know, where are we with our agriculture right now, which is a mess? And how does regen play into that as a solution? And we'll start with that.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with our food system, like you said, it's a mess and it's complex. You know, I mean, it goes to what is the saying? We have a food system that doesn't pay attention to our health and a healthcare system that doesn't pay attention to our food.
Yeah.
You know, so there's realities like that. And unfortunately, it seems I don't see evil people abound. I just see incentives,
right,
that create negative outcomes that are pervasive, particularly in government. And so I think lobbying and persuasion and influence has steered us, you know, astray in that regard. And I think this, our food system in general is no different. When you think about the most significant lobbying dollars in Washington come from some combination of big food and big ag, big chemical, big pharmaceutical, and big petroleum. They have a very significant interest in maintaining the status quo. You think about the scale of agriculture, therefore the scale of the challenge that we're faced with. It is roughly 50% of the land mass of the United States, roughly 30% of land across the globe that isn't covered in ice.
Massive.
And you can confirm that anytime you're in a plane and you look down, you see the, you know, all the little squares beneath you. That's how much we're doing agriculture. And if you think about that being roughly 900 million acres out of 2.2 billion acres in the United States, that's the amount of land that we tend to till and spray herbicide, fungicide, pesticide, fertilizer that comes from those chemical companies. And we run a tractor 5 times a year, which is a lot of diesel. And 80% of antibiotics go into, you know, animal agriculture so that you can promote growth and sustain life in environments that wouldn't really otherwise be compatible with life. And so, you think about what you're competing against. You look to the Farm Bill, which is the most significant piece of legislation influencing our food production system. And it went from saving farmers and ranchers, coming out of that Dust Bowl era where, hey, we need to create a backstop and an incentive for people to keep working the land because we need food as a society and we need people to maintain, take the risk and to make sure that they're supported if there's something beyond their control. And it's morphed into a captured system that effectively pushes farmers off of their land, squeezes them out of the supply chain, and further taxpayers then subsidize cheapening of our food. We largely produce corn and soy, which is why corn and soy is in everything in the supermarket. And it's why corn and soy are fed to animals, because we produce them and sell them onto the open market at less than the cost of production on the backs of taxpayer dollars at the expense of the very people that this system and this policy was really intended to save. In fact, I think there was a long period of time where we had to pay the government of Brazil $180 million a year because they sued us for flooding the international markets with these commodity crops at less than the cost of production. And so, look at that reality, and it's really clear why it's difficult to disrupt or break free of that cycle, whether you're a farmer who's trying to make their ends meet, trying to maintain their sense of identity and self-worth, their legacy in a system that's failing them, or a consumer who's looking to buy real food that they can be proud of the impact it has to a broad group of stakeholders, as well as the benefit it brings to them and their family. And so, I think agriculture has gone the way of those incentives. And I think the last thing I'll say, because I'll just talk forever on this, is I think, and again, I don't want to assume negative intent or that there's evil. I think a big part of the green revolution in agriculture, go big or go home, make things cheaper. Yeah. I mean, what you hear today that I think should be questioned, but make food more accessible, more cost effective, feed a growing population. Those were truly your intentions a generation ago. I can't argue with that. That seems honorable.
Right.
I think now we have seen enough and learned enough to know, okay, what we thought we had to do was not necessarily what we needed to do. And what we think the trade-offs must be aren't necessarily so either. And further, we can also see the consequences of that policy. And we can see all of the negative externalities that are being swept under the rug. We have to address those. They're creating problems, right? Pollinators dying off, dead zones in oceans, our waterways being poisoned, glyphosate showing up in breast milk and urine, the food system being insecure and unstable, most counties across the United States being declared disaster areas due to drought and local precipitation-related challenges, lack of carbon in our food production systems, life expectancy declining, fertility declining. I mean, all of this stuff points back to food and externalities and the consequences, the unintended consequences of decisions that were made a generation ago. So fine, well-intentioned effort back then, but we have to be accountable to those outcomes and learn and pivot and make the adjustments. And it seems that there's such an obvious alternative in the form of regenerative agriculture, where instead of combating our food production systems, our land and nature, we can align with it, work within its cycles, leverage human capacity for technology and ingenuity to celebrate the brilliance that instilled that fertility that we've been mining and extracting from for decades, and reinvest in those food systems, address and mitigate all those challenges I just rattled off, create more hope and opportunity for food producers, for food processors, and for consumers, and take a course correction from making food cheap to reminding ourselves that food should be affordable, but it should also be valuable. We've celebrated cheapness over value. We need value back in our food systems. And so, I think that's how I would probably frame the history and the path from where we had been 2 generations ago to where we are now. And I think the opportunity for what is seemingly a subtle pivot these aren't massive shifts, and we don't need to tear it down and rebuild it so it can rise from the ashes like a phoenix. And it's going to be this overwhelmingly impossible pursuit. It's subtle shifts. It's consumers thinking critically, paying attention, voting with their dollars, sending signals to large incumbents, like General Mills or Cargill or Tyson, saying, hey, you know, we want more value. When you made the decision that you were going to save 5 cents on your chicken and it was going to come at the expense of torturing these animals, I'm willing to pay that 5 cents. You never asked me, I'm telling you now, you know? And so give that choice and transparency back to consumers. I don't think the answer is building complex supply chains and manufacturing plants to take food, adulterate it, create a new form of food that emulates a pre-existing form of food, and to call it better or more efficient simply because you can patent it and own it and centralize wealth through it.
Totally. And I think an important thing in that messaging also is, like, we went along thinking that this was the cheaper option. Here's how we can make food inexpensive. But the reality is the long-term cost of that is far more expensive than what the label is saying in the grocery store. And I think that's a really important message for people to remember, that the price they're paying for that cheap meat or such is actually costing far more than what is ringing in the store.
Oh, yeah. You want to get me on a soapbox, I'll start talking about the true cost of food. And I would agree. I think, you know, our products might be seen as expensive because they are premium to the category. But the truth is the full cost is reflected in the product, and it's creating solutions. In fact, our system, I mentioned externalities a moment ago, in a regenerative system, the externalities you celebrate because they're positive, all of them. And I did some math. I was talking to Mark Hyman, and I think he points to the cost of chronic disease every year in our country, preventable chronic disease, being like $3.7 trillion. And if you break that down on a per household basis, that's $557 a week per household. And so, you know, just think about it from a food perspective, add that to your weekly grocery bill. That's the hidden cost of cheap food. That's not affordable for an overwhelming.
It's not sustainable at all.
It's profound. And that's just the healthcare cost, right? Again, we're not talking about the fact that our food systems are being desertified to the extent where they're no longer going to be capable of producing food if we continue down this path. And it's, you know, there's so many other areas that aren't calculated into that equation. But that one single variable is so profound when you want to really talk about whether the food is expensive or cheap or elite or available. And then the last thing I'd say is perspective, right? Like, I get asked the question, oh man, but it's so expensive. You know, how do you address that? Because it's inaccessible to people. And I have to stop and say, wait a minute, I think we need to challenge the premise of the question, because it's actually not expensive. We're just conditioned to believe it. In fact, on a per ounce basis, our ground beef is half the price per ounce as Ruffles potato chips.
Wow.
And it'll give you all of the nutrients that you need.
That's a pretty good comparison.
and it won't bring you any of the harm. And if you go to a 7-Eleven and buy a club sandwich and a big gulp and a bag of chips, you know, you're going to spend more for that meal than you would spend on two servings of ground beef and some frozen organic vegetables in a stir fry that, again, would be incredibly nourishing and far more cost effective. Not to mention a value meal at Chick-fil-A is $12 to $15 now. And so it's like, how is the most nutrient dense food in the store that came from a living sentient animal expected to be the cheapest food product on the planet, if it's even reasonably priced relative to Ruffles, let alone bourbon, wine, olive oil, you know, almonds in bulk, water, vinegar, you know, like, why does meat need to be so cheap as it? So I just think that we have a really confused relationship with food and meat in particular, and we start talking about the cost.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's just a confusing relationship with meat kind of in general, not just the cost. So I'd love to go down that path of meat, as you talk about meat and plants and climate. But, you know, on the whole, you guys are investing in these partnerships with ranchers and farmers around the country to bring these amazing meats to consumers and really having this positive impact on the land. And so I'd love for you to talk about the relationship between the animals and the land and how we should be thinking about, you know, for those people in their head who've heard, like, we should be eating plants because that's the best thing for our climate and that meat is bad. And so, yes, there are meats that are bad factory farmed. So kind of going into what you guys are doing and how the animals play into the ecosystem versus maybe some misconceptions that people are hearing.
So I think the way I'll approach that is I'll start with, there are no thriving ecosystems that consist of solely animals or solely plants. So this driving for hours down the road and seeing nothing but rows of corn is really bad. Much like driving down the road and passing a confined animal feeding operation and seeing tens of thousands of cattle in a confined space, also really bad. What causes ecosystems to thrive is plants and animals in harmony, diversity, right? I mean, the core tenets and principles of regenerative agriculture include a bunch of things. I can go through those and describe it, but you're asking specifically about the animal impact part, so I'll focus on that. And I'll just say that plant-based agriculture does not deserve a free pass. In fact, it's probably worse than animal agriculture, and the worst aspects of animal agriculture are the parts that come from the plants going to feed the animals. And again, animal agriculture also doesn't deserve a free pass. We wouldn't be here if there wasn't a true need to make serious improvements and adjustments. The reason animals aren't the enemy and that exterminating them isn't a solution in any way is, again, goes back to the ecosystem. It goes back to the environment. It goes back to the land and the fertility. We're evolution, biology, right? What creates thriving ecosystems besides just the presence of plants and animals? It's them fulfilling their evolutionary potential, their role, particularly with species that we would consider keystone, meaning they have a disproportionate impact to an environment relative to their numbers. And the bison, for example, just like any megafauna or large ruminant animal on any continent, was keystone to the North American ecosystem. And what they would do is roam from Mexico to Canada, these bison. And if you followed history or read the journals of Lewis and Clark, you could see their numbers were massive, somewhere between 30 and 60 million. And the settlers or explorers might have to wait days to a week for a herd to go by. Imagine that amount of impact. And
I can't even imagine
these grasslands, which again have turned into farmland, evolved alongside that type of impact. And those relationships were symbiotic. And in times of drought, those animals were bringing water in the form of urine. Think about a million animals peeing in a spot, not to sound gross, but like that's life-saving. Their wallows are habitat for and species of amphibians that have gone extinct. Birds' nests, baby birds have like a 30% increased chance of survival if they incorporate bison fur into their nest, because it limits smells and creates insulation and, you know, all of these sorts of things, like subtle things, but also big things, how the grass grows and how photosynthesis happens. And so these animals evolved to have an impact that the environment around them evolved to rely on. Those are ecosystem services. And in a regenerative system, you manage animals, particularly keystone animals, in a way where you can emulate those natural cycles and those natural relationships and those positive ecosystem services to produce outcomes that benefit the environment, which also create food for humans. And again, animals, bison roaming across the plains also created foods for humans and other predators and things like that. And so that's the, at its simplest form, without getting into the science of how they're positively impacting through photosynthesis and other things. And we can talk about carbon and water and so many other important aspects of this that they, you know, kind of are a catalyst for. That's why animals aren't our enemy, much like carbon's not our enemy. Again, you take the water out, we're carbon. You and I are sitting here talking, like, we shouldn't villainize things just because we don't understand them. We should look into the complexity and find where's the glide path that I can work with instead of fighting, right? Again, you know, nature produces hurricanes and tidal waves and tornadoes. Like, I'm not going to fight that. I'd rather have nature on my side than in my sights, because I know who's going to win in the long run.
So one particular thing as it relates to the cycle and the biodiversity and regen is certainly the soil. And would love for you to talk a little bit about the role that the animals are playing, because certainly the soil is at the heart of the ecosystem, and having that healthy soil, you know, from my perspective, it's like getting that nutrient dense soil is affecting our health, right? And without it, where we've been is having this soil that we're losing soil. It's lack of minerals and nutrients. And so the animal is really helping to restore that. And we'll love to talk about that relationship with soil. And then as that also relates to what you guys have done at Rome Ranch, because I think seeing firsthand a farm and then what you've done by creating this diversity and the change in soil, et cetera.
Yeah. So, you know, taking what I just said and then and carrying that forward into this question, maybe I'll talk about the principles of regenerative agriculture.
Sure.
And use that to color, you know, that. So the first principle is, there's really no particular order, but limit chemical and mechanical disturbance. So don't spray chemicals all over the place. Don't till it up. Don't destroy it. It's not saying never, ever. It's just saying limit. Because again, context matters. There's a time and place for everything and tools. But, you know, we till multiple times a year. We spray all the time. Like, these things are devastating. They have very significant consequences that they should be limited in every way possible, and every alternative should be pursued. Keeping the soil covered or armored, again, weeds, right? Or leaf litter or anything. In the summer, bare soil can get upwards of 150 degrees past the well done point of a stake designed to kill pathogens. All the life in the soil dies. The rhizosphere or even further in the soil, we know less about that than we do about the oceans or the rainforest. And yet it's where all food comes from. In fact, the health of the soil is going to be representative of the health of everything that comes out of the soil, which will be representative of the health of everything that relies on it. So without healthy soil, we're screwed. We certainly don't want to cook it. There's more life in a teaspoon of healthy soil or a tablespoon of healthy soil than there have ever been humans to set foot on the planet. You know, this is very, very, very deep, so thorough, and complex. And there's an economy down there. And so, you know, you want to promote that. We can't think of it as a substrate that we can contrive and control to just produce food from. It's a whole system. So I got a little carried away there. I'll be a little more to the point. Keep it covered. Again, rain, erosion. Our number one export in the United States is topsoil. It takes about 500 plus years to create an inch of topsoil. In nature, we lose 2 billion tons a year. To represent the amount of topsoil the U.S. loses on an annual basis, you would need to line up a billion trucks.
Wow.
Like pickup trucks. That would, for visual purposes, wrap around the equator 150 times. That's how much we lose every year of this non-renewable resource that takes hundreds of years to develop in nature, that is fundamental and necessary to food production and life, terrestrial life. And that is absolutely existential if we don't honor and replenish and invest in that resource. So cover the soil. It allows for better moisture retention as well. Living plants and green growing plants and living roots year round. Weeds aren't bad. They're there for a reason. You know, nature is calling on its tools and resources to do a job. Whenever something is happening in nature, there is a reason for it. It's not an accident. It's not our enemy. In fact, the reason we want green growing plants is one of the hot button topics of today. We need photosynthesis happening. And if anybody who made it through elementary school remembers science class and photosynthesis 101, which is about the extent of my knowledge here. So you're going to learn everything I know about photosynthesis. And I think it's everything the average person needs to know. Plants bring in CO2 and emit oxygen, right? So CO2 in, O2 out, what's left behind? The C, it's the carbon. And what's happening is the green leaves are taking the energy of the sun and that carbon out of the atmosphere, and they're converting it into energy and sugars, and they're converting it into the plant itself. And so they're drawing down carbon, growing their capacity to draw down more carbon, and then their roots actually inserting carbon into the soil to feed all that micro biological life in the soil, the mushrooms, the mycorrhizal fungi, all the bacteria, all the things, they kickstart. That is the currency down there, in fact, is what these plants deliver through their roots and through photosynthesis. And it's one thing that we need. We need more photosynthesis happening. So we need more green growing plants and living roots. heck, the atmosphere is about 80%. I think it's like 78% nitrogen. Why are we spraying nitrogen when we have plants that are nitrogen fixing, like legumes and turnips and things like that, that we can put in and they can do a job the way nature intended. So that's you know, green growing plants, living roots, diversity. Everything has a role. It's insane that we spray insecticide, right? Because for every undesirable insect species, there are thousands of desirable insect species that do, again, really important jobs that are necessary. It's only when we indiscriminately and unselectively eliminate all insect life that we create an opportunity for a plague or our undesired outcome, which is an overwhelming introduction of something that is undesirable that can really, you know, kill an entire crop. So let diversity, let different plants, like I said, nitrogen fixing plants versus others, and then animal impact. Animals have a role, just like all the rest of this stuff. They have a job that's important. And I mentioned them roaming. I mentioned how they create habitat and other things. But, you know, what would have happened more specifically is, and how we represent this in a regenerative system to emulate that cycle of nature, is roaming, moving animals around, right? So mob grazing, rotational grazing, but essentially letting them have a significant impact on a single spot. And then moving them on as if they were a densely populated herd that is then leaving an area not to come back for a period of time. What that does is it causes fertilization through their feces, watering through their urine, compaction from their hooves, pushing dead and oxidizing material down to the surface of the soil to cover it and armor it, then to feed the microbiology because it's there to then decay. Again, life, death, decay, new life, right? And then they move on. And then it allows for recovery, which is what they would have done. They would have not had that impact for a while, but they need it, you know? And so, you know, then you move your animals around and allow that sort of cycle to be honored. That's what a ruminant might do. The right balance of different types of animals, whether it be poultry or whether it be pigs. Again, they all have a role. And you can find a way to let them celebrate that role on the land through how you manage them. And the last one is context. Just knowing your strengths, weaknesses, and opportunities. If you're somebody that's independently wealthy, there's a resource that you can use to manage your land regeneratively. If you have 10 kids, there's a resource that you can use to manage your land regeneratively. If you're in a very cold or very wet or very warm or very dry environment, again, your approach is going to be different. So you have to know your context. And how to apply these principles, it's going to be different. It's going to be flexible. But again, animals are keystone to triggering and fundamental to so much of this circle and this cycle.
Yeah, that was a great explanation. Thank you for that. So as you look to initially, when you started Force of Nature, look to your supply chain and setting up the different ranching partners that you had, was Rome Ranch at day one of the business, had that already started? Let's get into that.
It's a great question. You know, I think one of the cool things about Katie and Taylor, when we sold Epic, and they were the original founders, you know, I was part of the, you know, I was an instrumental and founding employee, and we led it democratically together, but they started it. And they took, at a time when, you know, they sold, they could have taken their money and bought a house on an island somewhere, you know, and escaped all this mayhem. But they really doubled down and walked the walk and bought a ranch just west of Austin in a town called Fredericksburg, and turned it into a regenerative field experiment and educational facility. And that was probably within 6 months of the acquisition. And I was fortunate enough that when we brought bison out there, they let me put some animals in the herd. So mm-hmm.
So what was the ranch before they bought it? Was it just regular conventional farm? What were you guys changing it from?
Yeah, I mean, it was regular in the sense of it being severely desertified, damaged, mismanaged conventionally, industrially for a long period of time. You walk through several of the fields, there was no life on it. It was almost truly dirt and sand, not real soil. And it needed some TLC. It needed to be managed properly. Yeah. And it was interesting because the neighbors were sort of like, who are these people from Austin coming out to the country and trying to say they're going to manage land differently? And they may have a truck now, but they'd started with a Prius. So what the heck do they know? Lots of skeptics, lots of maybe in the community, some jest jeers. But within a short period of time, the neighbors were knocking, saying, hey, actually, we'd like to lease you our land so that you can begin to manage your animals here so that we can see some of these benefits, as well as they started to see more ground cover, more density of ground cover, better, you know, water infiltration, and particularly important when you have long periods without rain that you're able to infiltrate and store as much rain as possible. More wildflowers. Again, it's just like you want your land base to be improving, not degrading. And they saw that happening. And so, you know, pretty quickly, now it's, 7 years later, but within the first few years, it was still obvious that there was something really good happening. And now it's beyond undeniable and exciting. But those early days, it was still a lot of learning and trial and error and challenge. But they, again, let me put some animals in the herd. And we got to a point where we needed to move meat. And so you have to, in order to do all of that, you need a revenue stream that allows you to keep investing in the land base. And so many times that's what the offtake is, or the product you produce is plants and animals, is food. And so when we started Force of Nature, we knew that our sort of home farm was going to be Rome Ranch, even though it's an entirely separate entity. It's owned exclusively by Katie and Taylor. It is truly just one supply partner of many supply partners that Force of Nature has. It also happens to be like in our family, you know, it's like separate house, but it's part of the family. So that's a little bit about where Rome came into play. Again, I keep going, but I feel like you want to ask a different question. So I want to.
No, I want to hear about all the diversity, because what is so cool about what you're doing is the diversity of meats that you have and things that I think would not be accessible to most people typically. I mean, I definitely wasn't buying organ meats before, and now I'm buying your ancestral blend and having that like once a week. So would love to talk about that diversity of animals that you have. And for those who don't know, what are the benefits of these organ meats too?
Funny thing about our organ meats. So we call those our ancestral blends. And when we came up with that line, we knew that organs are the most nutrient dense thing there was by many measures, but we also knew that they weren't popular for their flavor profile.
You just had a bad PR person for a while.
Yeah. Well, and further, this was like the first year where, you know, United States American life expectancy for children being born was lower than the generation before. And it was like, wait a minute. So we're now officially, our progress is now officially causing us to live shorter lives. We've never been more distanced from what our ancestors would have selected for from a dietary perspective. They would have gone to the organs first, much like many animals in the animal kingdom go to the organs first. You know, they would have been unselective and honoring the whole animal and eating the carcass, whereas we just want a ribeye or whatever it might be. And so how do we bring that ancestral wisdom forward? How do we honor the animal? How do we help consumers, but also be sensitive to the modern palate? So hence the ancestral blend, which we created and named accordingly. And then did it, you know, also like, I mean, fed it to our first batch. I fed to my nieces and nephews, and I was like, will these kids know that they're eating hamburgers that have heart and liver in it? And they were like, Uncle Robbie, we love it. This is so good. Like, your hamburgers are great. And so I was like, of course, I didn't tell them. That was the point. Yeah, that was a really official and expensive food testing that we did in the early days, our kids. And so, yeah, I mean, like they're wildly popular for that reason, right? You get the benefit of organs without the, you know, the off taste or sensitive again to the modern palate. And what are those benefits of organs? It's the nutritional density. It's the macro and micronutrients you get per ounce or per gram. It was interesting. I think it's Ty Beal a while ago published a really cool study on the most common nutrient deficiencies across the globe, and then, you know, even more focused on the most common nutrient deficiencies in the United States. And not surprisingly, or maybe surprisingly, actually, more than half the population is deficient in numerous key nutrients. And it tends to be even more women than not, iron being a primary example, I think zinc, magnesium, some of the B vitamins. So the reference to Tybeal was a study that was done that said, hey, you know, in order to get the appropriate daily amount of daily allowance of these micronutrients, how much of a particular food would a person need to eat in order to give them what they need and are lacking? And it was something like 11 calories of liver, which is like,
oh my God,
you know, just,
that's crazy.
Versus like over 1,000 calories of chicken meat.
Right.
And so,
wow.
And again, you can look up the study. Don't you, please do fact check that, because I probably misrepresented it to some degree, but not, but at a broad level, it's that profound in terms of the value that you can, the bang for buck that you can get from these items. So again, I'm only incorporating a small amount into these grinds, but you don't need a lot to get what most people need. I just think it's really cool. And it's also slightly frustrating, because when we first started doing, I mean, we did organ bars at Epic, you know, and people like, you'll take the livers, like, please, can I pay you to take these from me? And now it's like, they're more expensive than the meat, the trim that's going into the product. So it's become really popular with people to put in pills and other things. But hey, that's great. You know, it's more value making it back to the farmer, more respect for the animal, more appreciation for the food. Good for the industry, good for consumers.
How hard has it been for you, talking about having more people consuming these organ meats, growing your supply chain and getting more ranchers across the country who are farming in a regenerative way?
It's a challenge, but again, a huge part of the reason we started Force of Nature was because we knew that we could grow and scale these systems faster than demand for the products was developing. That's not to say that demand wasn't growing. It just wasn't growing as fast as we could turn systems over and transfer, you know, by saying turn systems over, I mean transition from conventional to regenerative. And so, you know, we've seen hundreds of thousands of acre size ranches convert from grain finishing to managing regeneratively and grass, you know, finishing animals on grass and so on. So it's, you know, with the right opportunity and the right alignment and trust and competence and partnership, scale isn't a challenge. Again, making sure that consumers who have been used and misled to their own detriment have access and a transparent level of awareness to the system that they're a party to, and to the challenges and the shortcuts that have been taken, and have an opportunity to see that there's an alternative and have access to that alternative. And so like, that's the biggest thing here is, and why I'm so grateful for this opportunity to talk with you, is just reaching consumers and saying, hey, look, if you're listening to this, you give a shit, you know? And if you're going to the grocery store and you're buying product because it says natural, or you're buying something that says, because it says organic or non-GMO, it means you're willing to pay a premium for something you perceive as better. Let's make sure that that perception isn't assumed and it's earned. You know, let's make sure that we're actually, we are the manifestation of what you expect. When you pay a premium for something, you should get a premium quality product back. You shouldn't be paying a premium because somebody marketed well and they're able to get extra dollars from you without actual substance and follow through on the front lines. And so I think that's what we're just trying to show consumers. I'm not trying to change their preferences. I'm trying to say, when you go buy a product because you think it has better welfare, or because you think it's better for the environment, or because you think it's better for you, good for you. You're not wrong for wanting to do those things. Let's just make sure it actually delivers. And I think so many companies have taken advantage of that, the good and the positive intentions of consumers, and abused that trust. And I think you know, I take issue with that. And so what we're trying to do is create transparency and saying, hey, look, this is what the system looks like. Here's an alternative. If you align and agree with that, then great, come support this. If you don't, no judgment. You know, you do, life's hard enough. You don't need me ridiculing you, but I'm definitely not going to stand by and watch you be used, abused, and taken advantage of.
Yep.
Well, I love the impact that you guys are having and the way that you're making this more accessible to more people around the country is just going to have that much bigger of an impact. So we are going to close it out with three rapid fire questions. A favorite force of nature moment so far?
Man, you know, the early days, you know, it's funny when you do startups, you always think, you know, it's like whenever things are really rough, you know, the thing that you like, a battle cry that we have to get ourselves through it, where we can at least smile through pain, is like, just remember, these are the good old days.
Right.
So I think, like, you know, I think back to, you know, the first show we ever did, where we made up a brand, bought stuff from the store, took the labels off, stuck our stickers on it, totally fake it till you make it, showed up to the show just to test the reception. And the reception was overwhelmingly positive. And, you know, we got some account acceptances and some momentum, and some of it back home. We're like, okay, cool.
Now we got to start.
Like an actual product, put it in an actual, you know. And then, of course, the rest is history. So I think, you know, stuff like that, where you're just kind of leaning in and you're going to figure it out as you go. It's always fun to look back and laugh at and be like, you remember when we did that? That was crazy.
I love that. That's such a good one. Favorite words to live by?
You know, there's a Ralph Waldo Emerson quote, something along the lines of, don't waste life in doubts and fears. Spend each moment as if it's the best preparation for the ages, you know, the hours and ages that follow, right? It's like, kind of, that makes me think of that focus on what you can control and just do the best you can and not put too much pressure on yourself. I think that's a really cool, it's something that's always inspired me. There's probably a million quotes. I just love quotes, so I could probably just pick a different one, but when you asked the question, that one came to mind. Just, you know, do the best you can. Life comes at you fast. Just, you know, try to make sure you're setting yourself up for the long-term success.
That's a great one. And lastly, what is your number one non-negotiable to thrive on your wellness journey?
Yeah, food values. You know, I've just sort of embraced that people think I'm a weirdo, you know, because I won't poison myself with things that have been normalized. And you know, I guess a term that got popularized, hopefully it's not controversial. Everything's controversial, so I guess who cares?
Yeah.
But was like this idea of group formation psychosis. And I'm like, when I heard that term, it was being applied to some other stuff, we'll say. But what I thought of immediately was like, oh, it's our relationship with food. We justify all these horrible things that we put in our bodies or do to ourselves because other people do it. And like, the crowd is all the livings are running off the cliff. So let's just run with them. And I think, you know, I think of food like a credit card. You know, you hear people say like, oh, I'm working on this, I'm doing this. You know, kind of like, I'm being thrifty and spending to my budget, and you get a credit card bill and you're like, holy smokes, what happened? I thought I was being good. This is terrible. You see all the little things add up. And I think it's really easy from a food perspective to turn any day that ends in Y into a cheat day and not even realize that you're doing it, not really have that vision and understanding. And so I think having and not being so rigid that you take the joy out of life. You know, there's so many, like, you're purely Elizabeth, right? Like, you do tons of things in a really healthy way. That means you don't have to take the fun out of food and being focused and disciplined and sticking to your values and your ideals. As far as, again, the question's about the wellness journey, right? So it's like food rules. I mean, you just can't compromise there and continue to stay curious. I think it's easy this day and age to get dogmatic. Again, I don't know your whole story, but almost everybody I know in this space was vegetarian or vegan at one point, struggled and has converted to, you know, paleo or something else. And I think that's awesome. I think staying curious and listening and having an ear to the ground and thinking critically about what you're being told when it comes to your wellness journey is really important, because it's you could get cornered into a dogma and find it really difficult to break out of that echo chamber if you're not open-minded.
Yeah, I think being open-minded, listening to your body, and those are so important. Well, in closing, where can everybody find you and what is next for Force of Nature?
Forceofnature.com is our website. We have products and blogs and all kinds of things.
Great recipes.
Yeah, oh yeah, recipes. Heck yeah. Honestly, like, please visit our website and don't buy anything. You know, I'll sell to you unapologetically if you do buy something wonderful and thank you in advance. But just go learn a little bit about where your food comes from. Learn a little bit about what opportunities might be out there. You have a favorite farmer at your local farmer's market, go buy something from them and not us, but ask them some questions and help, you know, understand where they have opportunities and needs and support them in it. But just pay attention, keep an ear to the ground. We're at Force of Nature Meats on Instagram. Taylor, one of my co-founders, has an awesome podcast called Where Hope Grows. I'd encourage you to check out some episodes. And then again, just let us be a conduit to you informing yourself. And if you buy something, great. We're available at a bunch of grocery stores. We have a Find Us page on the website. So we'd like to make it easy for you, but I'd like to inspire you first.
Amazing. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for joining me on Live Purely with Elizabeth. I hope you feel inspired to thrive on your wellness journey. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, subscribe, and review. You can follow us on Instagram at purely_Elizabeth to catch up on all the latest. See you next Wednesday on the podcast.